Welcome to Rooster Radio, where we talk to interesting people doing amazing things. I'm Andrew Montesi with James Begley. Make sure you subscribe to Rooster Radio on iTunes or your favourite podcast player so you don't miss a thing. In this episode, Andrew Buttery shares his amazing business story. It started with Gemtree Wines, the Buttery family business of which Andrew was managing director. Business was good, but upon meeting a Chinese investor, things took a dramatic turn. It took 3 years for Andrew to facilitate the relationship and then a partnership in China, but it paid off for the company big time. Gemtree was growing at a staggering rate and was the export poster child for the South Australian government, until the Chinese partner's business hit the wall. Andrew then packed his bags and moved to China on a mission to save both the partner's company and his own. Andrew shares his remarkable story with stacks of insights and lessons learned about doing business in China, along with the personal toll he ended up leaving the family business completely burnt out. Andrew is now rejuvenated and working with Organic and Raw, a beverage company growing at a rapid rate on the back of its Mojo kombucha drink, which is another great story in its own right. Enjoy our chat with Andrew Buttery, which is sure to become a Rooster Radio favourite. Andrew, welcome to our podcast.
Thank you very much, James.
We every day get our little bottle of Mojo kombucha, and this is fact, and we come in and we tip it upside down and we just watch this sediment float around. What is it actually that we're drinking?
All the good bits.
Yeah.
What, you mean the kombucha? What is it? Well, kombucha is basically a brewed tea that is fermented. And so we brew tea, so we get green and black tea leaves, a blend of those. We brew the tea, we boil the tea, then we add sugar. So we cool it down, add sugar, and then we add a thing called a SCOBY, which is a symbiotic culture of bacteria and yeast.
What sort of scale? You got these massive vats, I'm assuming?
No, they're actually quite small.
Oh.
Yeah, so, you know, they might be, I don't know, 100 litre little fermenters.
Yep. And how much of this culture, like, is it a cup of culture?
Well, it starts as a very small, probably a diameter of a cup, and then over the course of two weeks or so, it grows to cover the entire diameter or the surface of the fermenter.
My wife brews it at home, and I remember the first time she started doing it, I think I walked into the kitchen, there was numerous jars, and it looked like a science lab with kind of like some sort of animal fetus or something like in this jar. It's actually pretty disgusting.
It's very ugly looking.
Yeah.
It's very ugly looking.
And when you we're taught that when things are growing in and around food or drink, that's generally not a good thing.
Well, generally it isn't, but in this case it's really good for you.
Yeah.
So that whole, you know, so just to finish that, you know, the culture that we add to it then basically turns the sugar into alcohol, and then the bacteria in the culture breaks down the alcohol, and that whole, I suppose, symbiotic process of fermentation results in a very low alcohol drink, like, you know, 0.5% of alcohol, but then it's left with, you know, good probiotics and gluconic acids, and vitamin B12 is another byproduct.
We did a podcast with KI Spirits, and, you know, the genesis of how gin came about was a bit fascinating. I mean, how do people kind of get to a point where they realise that, A, that this can happen, and then, B, it's good for you?
Well, they say that they were doing kombucha a couple of thousand years BC, and it was found in China initially. So they say the warriors, you know, when they went into battle, would have kombucha to give them strength. So, you know, so look, that's whether it's hearsay or not, but there's enough evidence in the historical journals to indicate that they were doing kombucha back then. But, you know, I mean, people have been making kombucha on their own, in their own homes for years. But it really wasn't until like 2003, 2004 in the US commercially that kombucha started to hit the shelves. And in Australia, it only started hitting the shelves around 2010. So it's still relatively, there's the awareness of kombucha is still quite low. You know, I haven't been in this industry for a long time, but I still, every time I talk to people about kombucha, I still have people have a glazed look over their eyes around the word kombucha. They've never heard of it before.
Oh, I didn't until 6 months ago. I'd never heard of it until Monty started spruiking it.
Yeah. Making it in their own homes is interesting because, or at least Hannah's homebrew it's a pretty raw and, it's a little bit tough to drink. Is that, I guess, this market development side of it, is that a real challenge? You got to actually explain like what you're doing now. You're explaining what it is, and then you also got to probably almost warn people. The taste is a little bit different. It's not necessarily going to be everyone's cup of tea.
That's exactly how you've got to go about it. And I've been at the way we try and introduce kombucha to people is face-to-face in demonstrations. So the more product demos we can do, the better. And we're now in Costco. So, I've been and watched some demonstrations at Costco. I haven't done the demonstrations, but I've watched the Costco people do their demonstrations. And it's a slightly different demographic of people that comes to a Costco. And I've seen people's faces screw up when they have a slightly vinegary character that they weren't expecting, and I've seen people actually spit the product out.
So this is when they're having the giant pizza from Costco and they've got their trolley full of toilet paper, and then you go and hand them a little shot of kombucha, and they're not expecting it.
But you really have to try and give them a heads up before they consume the product, and some people just. They have sweet palates. They're used to having a lot of sugar in their diet, and they just can't get their head around it. Because acetic acid is a byproduct of the fermentation process. So, that's the slightly vinegary character.
How do you then, I guess, change that perception? I mean, are people doing it for health initially? They go, well, might not like the taste, but for health reasons, I'm going to persist with it. Is that the hook?
Yep. So if you think about where we started as a company, we started selling in health food stores. So so Anthony Crabb, our CEO, I mean, he literally was making kombucha in his shed at home, bottling it by hand, and then putting it in the back of his car and going out and trying to convince health food stores to put it in their fridges. And those people that were visiting health food stores either brewed their own kombucha or were very health conscious, and so they were more likely to have a go at drinking it. So that was really where we seeded, the Mojo brand through the health food channel.
So the company was founded 2009?
Yeah.
Was that right?
Yeah.
So it's in the back of a shed getting driven around. To fast forward for context, where's it at now?
I'd say we're in a supercharge mode. So 2010, we moved from Anthony's shed to a facility in Wollonga, and that was one shed. We now have three. We've expanded our fermentation capacity significantly. We've just ordered a second bottling line, which will more than double our production capacity. And our sales over the last 4 years have been doubling year on year. And so this year is no different. We're expecting our sales to double. It just so happens that it's on a larger base. So the reason why it's doubling is we're now crossing from that health food channel into mainstream through the grocery channel. So, I was involved in the launch in Woolworths just over 12 months ago. Woolworths had never had kombucha. They took a gamble, and very quickly the product was accepted, and we started with two products in there. We've got four, and it's going gangbusters.
For those that don't know, me included, when you say, you knock on Woolworths' door and then it gets accepted, I'm assuming that's not an easy process. What actually happens?
Well, we have to do a trial. So we had to trial it in some stores in South Australia and prove to them that there was a market out there for it.
Can you just go and buy it up yourself?
You can. if things aren't going well, then you can go and buy a few bottles. That might have been done in the past. You never know. But, yeah, so, look, you have to trial it. Give the buyer, the category manager, some confidence that this thing's going to work. And then, you know, the category manager in our case gave us 3 states to launch in. And then, you know, within 12 months we, you know, we went national. So, fortunately, the market was ready to accept kombucha. And also we... what we did is we reformulated our kombucha and created a slightly smoother and lighter version, which we thought was going to be more suitable for mainstream consumers that might have heard about kombucha but hadn't really drunk much of it in the past.
So Woolies, Costco, who
we
else?
Just launched into Aldi as well, and we're in, you know, obviously Foodland and the IGAs around the country. So.
All states?
Yep, all states.
Can you tell us a little bit about the challenge of distribution? Because I'd imagine, I mean, I was looking at the use-by date on my Mojo the other day and it's kind of probably a month out from when I was drinking. Yep. I was thinking, geez, it could be a bit of a challenge moving stock around and keeping it alive.
The major challenge for us is we have it's a live cultured drink. So it has to be kept chilled between 1 and 5 degrees. If it's not kept chilled between 1 and 5 degrees, it will re-ferment in the bottle, and then, you know, you can have all sorts of issues. That can obviously increase the alcohol content in the bottle, and then you go outside of the specification that is acceptable to be able to sell that product on shelf, or it could explode or whatever. So, so there are less chilled distributors out there than what we call ambient distributors. There are less people set up to do chilled distribution. So finding quality distributors out there is our biggest challenge and is still our biggest challenge.
And so is that like at the moment almost a bit of a barrier to growth? Like you almost hit a bit of a ceiling because it becomes difficult to move the stock?
Not necessarily. Look, it's not necessarily. I think now we've crossed into grocery and mainstream, then there's the opportunities are opening up more and, you know, more quickly now. So our next focus is the petrol and convenience channel. So we're talking to On the Run. So we hopefully will launch in On the Run within 2 months, and that'll go into 80 to 100, you know, petrol and convenience stores around South Australia. You know, everyone knows On the Run here. You know, so it really shows that we're crossing into the mainstream, and they're looking at developing a range of, you know, they're looking to change the mix of products that they've got available. They want to offer healthier choices to their customer base. So, you know, as societal tastes change, we're playing into that space really nicely. So we've got distribution is always a challenge, finding the right distribution partners who are a good fit. And for us, a challenge for us at the moment is finding distribution partners who can service those new channels that we're trying to get to. And there are not many of them out there. I mean, if I went to Coke and did a deal with Coke tomorrow, that would give me incredible distribution, but Coke have their own products and do their own thing. So, you know, we have to find other partners that are smaller than Coke to help us get to the marketplace.
Having conversations now with, you know, with suppliers and different channels must be so much easier because of your, I guess, the case study of what you've already built.
Yep.
And it seems that you've had this collision now of all the things are aligning, including your brand, and it's a beautiful brand, great name. You know, I see there's a lot of stuff on Instagram in terms of that sort of lifestyle, young, fit, active sort of brand. How did you go about building the brand? What were the conscious elements that you focused on?
I think it really starts from the founders of the brand, and Anthony and Sarah are both very health conscious individuals, so they take a lot of care about what they consume and what they put in their bodies, and they, I suppose, wanted to create a company that would enhance people's health and well-being. So really, it's quite interesting. We've just done some research in the last couple of months, and a lot of our consumers are women. So there's probably 70 to 80% of Mojo consumers are women, and that probably is telling a bit of a message around women are more conscious about what they put in their bodies. They're quite specific now around diet. They're more active. So they're exercising, you know, 2 to 5 times a week. So really it's about, at the message and the brand is around tailoring, our messaging to, that aligns with the values of those people that are consuming our product. But, we're looking at developing more products. They're not going to be high sugar soft drinks. They're going to be products that enhance people's health and well-being, and that's the core values of what we're about.
In terms of growth and some of the triggers and drivers of growth, without asking you to reveal your secret sauce, what have been some of the big drivers so far?
The triggers for growth or drivers for growth?
Some of the marketing tactics that you've been using. I mean, Beg's mentioned Instagram. Mm. I mean, through Pixstar, we've been involved with you guys with that, which has been awesome. How's that been working?
Look, we've done this on a shoestring, to be honest. It's been a production-driven business, and the focus has been about delivering quality product and making sure that we get our processes right. You know, we early on engaged with SARDI, the South Australian Research Development Institute, and we got their food scientists to come in and work with us to make sure that we could commercialise kombucha and make sure that we can consistently deliver the same product day in, day out, and make sure people are safe as well, because, you know, there's alcohol issues with the product, et cetera. So the focus probably for the first 8 or 9 years of the business was very much around production, and really only in the last 18 months to 2 years has the business started to think more from a marketing perspective. And we're now, coming into the business, I've really been pushing the board to be more consumer driven and understand more about who our consumers are out there and what their needs are and what their interests are, so that we can then tailor our marketing message accordingly and work out how we can get to those people. We really don't spend a lot. We haven't spent a lot on marketing, but we are going to start spending more on marketing, because we'll have the luxury of doing that because we're growing at a pretty significant rate now, which is a great thing. It doesn't necessarily mean we're going to do that by, splashing it on mainstream TV. These days, as you guys know, through social media, there are some very effective ways of getting to people. And, the use of ambassadors and influencers is very important. And, we're developing our own tribe of ambassadors and influencers, but we're very specific about making sure that those people that are representing our brand actually drink our product and are committed to our product. So we don't want people to be talking about our product if we're paying them a heap of money and they don't really like kombucha. They don't really like Mojo. That just to us, that just doesn't fit with our core values.
Monty, this is probably a question for you, because you have, in part been canvassing the athletes as to, who would like to be involved in the business, and from an ambassador point of view, have you been shocked at the amount of people that are putting their hands up saying, "Oh, I already drink it," or "I love kombucha generally"? I mean, has that surprised you?
Yeah, it has been surprising. Even like we found an athlete, I think Reese Conker from Richmond, who's like, "Yeah, I've actually been making it myself." And Robbie Cornthwaite at Western Sydney, he's like, "Yeah, we've actually been drinking the product." So that's exactly what you want. That's a true ambassador. It's authentic. And I think what the problem with the social and influencer market at the moment is that's kind of got lost. It's called an influencer and an ambassador for a reason. You're actually supposed to
believe in it.
Believe in it. Like, yep. when all this started, it was someone who genuinely loved a product and actually wanted to talk about it. And these days it's kind of been flipped on its head. So to retain that, because as you say, authenticity is a big part of the brand.
Definitely.
You wouldn't want to lose that.
No. So we're really excited about the ambassadors we've got, and you know, we've got some great ones through you, and I think our relationship will continue to develop. But you know, people like Caitlin Bassett, who's captain of the Diamonds, you know, she's a fan, and you know, even Tex Walker, you know, who we've been delivering Mojo to his girlfriend, but Tex, he gets on the stuff as well. So, and he's getting on it through the Crows now because we're supplying it through the dietitian at the Crows. So, you know, Rory Sloan's another one. You know, these guys just genuinely want to look after their bodies and, you know, and they love our brand and our product, which is a bloody great thing.
What was the catalyst for you then being roped in to the fold?
The catalyst was I had been running our family business, which was a wine company, a biodynamic winery called Gem Tree in McLaren Vale. And I'd been doing that for the better part of 16 years. And that had been a really good journey, an exciting journey. And I got a Chinese partner involved in our business back in starting around 2010. But then things sort of didn't go quite according to plan with that Chinese partner. So by the time I'd sort of finished a process, I suppose, of working very closely with that partner for some time, I'd pretty well lost my passion for the wine business. And I decided that I wanted to do something different. And so I thought, I'll go and have a couple of cups of coffee with people, which is what you do when you're starting to think about doing something different. And I happened to have a conversation with a mate, an old mate who happens to be a shareholder of this business. And he said, you know, we're at a point where I think we need someone like you. And I hadn't even thought about coming into this type of business before. He'd actually given me some kombucha a couple of years before that and said, I want you to try this stuff and see what you think. And to be honest, I really didn't take that much notice at that point in time. You know, I'm health conscious and, you know, fit and active and whatever, but my head was around the wine business at that time and I wasn't, you know, I didn't take much notice. But you know, things move on. And when I started talking to him and the other shareholders, I really felt that this business was a great fit for me. And I'm, you know, so basically after a couple of months, we decided that I was going to make the jump and come across. And so I've done it and I haven't looked back. It's been a great ride in the first 12 months or so. And it's going to be a really exciting journey over the next couple of years, I think.
Loaded question, but when someone says to you, oh, I'm interested in getting my business into China, what do you say?
Be very careful. China, everyone goes, there's 1.3 billion consumers in China. Oh, we can make a shitload of money. It's just not that easy. It really isn't that easy. I mean, you've got to really commit yourself 110% to trying to make that work, whatever you do in China and whatever partners you find over there. I was doing business in China for a few years before I met the partner that we ended up taking on board, and we were going pretty well, but I had to invest a lot of time and effort into it. And, you know, you make a lot of sacrifices. You've got to try and learn some of the language and the customs and the rituals. And, you know, it's just really, it's a very challenging process to move into a market like China as opposed to a market like the UK or the US where you speak the same language, the cultures are very similar, but to have a completely different culture in China, the way they do business, the way they think, it takes a lot of extra work.
So you mentioned this Chinese partner. How long did it take you to bring this person on board, and what was involved in building that relationship?
So I got introduced where it started was a friend of mine was on the board of a mining company in Australia called IMX, and we happened to be away on a boys' camping trip.
You are smirking, just for the listeners.
Boys' camping trip over a few drinks, and he said, "I've got this, you know, guy, Mr. Song, who said he wants to get into the wine industry," and you know, I said, "Well, maybe you know you should introduce him to me, and I might be able to help him." Because we had a vineyard management business, so eventually around mid 2010, he came to town. We set up a meeting. We had a little mini bus. We took him on a tour around McLaren Vale. I showed him a few vineyards. Then we sat down for lunch at the end of the tour, and I said, "What did you think of the tour? Were you interested in any of the vineyards?" And he said, "Yeah, the vineyards were interesting, but I want to have a joint venture with you." So that was on the very first meeting that we had.
Did you get a bit boozy in that
last time? No, we weren't that. It wasn't that boozy. Okay. He wasn't a big drinker at all, he isn't a big drinker. I just about fell off my chair. And
you're thinking, this is going to be
thought,
easy.
This is just ridiculous. And you can imagine when I took that idea back to the family, they just all laughed at me and thought I was on drugs. And so from that point on, I then thought, well, look, I need to prove to myself that either this guy is bona fide, there's something in this. So I then set up another meeting when he was in Adelaide next. I introduced him to mum and dad. And then I went over to China and spent some time having meeting him on his turf and having a look at what he did over there. And so I got a better understanding, certainly, of the scale of his operation over there, and that was in property development, primarily property development. By having a number of meetings with him, seeing what he did over there, we then eventually got him by 2000 and sort of late 2011, we'd agreed, on a path forward, and my parents said they'll go out and he can come in. So they effectively bought my parents' share of the business. And that was very surprising because I'd never discussed with my parents about them exiting the business. But they saw an opportunity that the business could grow at a very rapid rate. They didn't have the interest in committing to that level of growth at that stage of their lives, and they thought, it's probably better to have a partner like Mr. Song working with us.
It's a massive call, though, isn't it? Because at the time you're a family business, and then all of a sudden this Chinese businessman knocks on the door.
Yep.
Were there tough conversations? Was it a bit emotional for the parents? What was that kind of process of working out, okay, yeah, maybe there's something in this?
Mm. Well, I think the tough conversations were even before, Mr. Song was around, because the business was tracking okay. We're probably a $3 million turnover business. We were doing some international as well as national, but we weren't making great money. It's just a bit of, the wine industry is a slog. There are not many wineries making great money. It's a great industry to be in. Everyone loves drinking wine. Most people love drinking wine, and there's really good people in the industry, lots of really interesting personalities. But it's hard to make money. So, we as a family, had to evaluate at one point in time, sort of probably late 2010, whether we were going to stay in this business or not, or keep the business in its current form or scale it down. And so I really, in my own mind, we sat around the table and I said, look, all right, let's come back here in 12 months' time and we'll work out whether we're going to, move forward in the same way. And by literally 12 months later, we'd done the deal in principle with Mr. Song, to move it forward. So initially, my brother-in-law and sister were very sceptical about bringing a Chinese partner in, but they warmed to it when they saw the potential opportunity for growth for our business and, enhancing the wealth of the family and whatever. They hopped on board and came along for the ride. And mum and dad, they're still very passionate about the Gemtree brand. They love what's been created and they love the wines that are produced. So they still feel essentially part of the business anyway, even though they're not financially invested in the business.
And look, things don't always go to plan, but I guess one of the questions about your own learnings and your own development within business, what have you learned about yourself in the way that you've responded to hard times?
Oh, geez, there's so many things probably. But I've certainly understood that I can be very resilient. So I've been through, you know, I actually had to go at one stage, and this is, I call this a Chinese roller coaster ride. So we went through incredible growth from our business. It went from literally a $3 million revenue business to a $10 million revenue business within 18 months to 2 years. And that was driven primarily on the back of sales into China. So there was an enormous amount of money that came into our business very quickly. And it was a really exciting time. So everyone wanted to know us. And Gemtree was the poster child of, you know, the South Australian economy. You know, the Premier was putting us up in lights and saying what a great example of a small business, you know, doing it good in China. So you can get carried away with that. And I've...
As in you just think this is exponential, this will just keep going.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, we were trying not to get ahead of ourselves, but it was pretty, you know, it was pretty hard when you, you know, just see this, you know, these orders coming out of China that were significant orders and, you know, all of a sudden we were making, great profits. So you can get it, you can get ahead of yourself and you need to, certainly, I think you need to seek counsel of people around you. I had counsel of a whole lot of people. I had lawyers, I had accountants and whatever. And all of those people were on board for where we were going with this. But just to preface the roller coaster is our Chinese partner actually got into financial trouble in sort of 2014, and he had a massive property development business. He built high-rise buildings, lots of residential buildings, not only in the Sichuan province but in a couple of other provinces. And he hit the wall. You know, the government changed its policy on credit, and the banks started pulling in their loans, and he was too heavily geared. And so he went into freefall mode. And so did his wine business. And so I was at a point where I could see that we were so closely linked out, the success of our business was so closely linked to China that I had to do something. If I didn't do something, we might not have survived. So I chose to go and work with his business in China, and I took on the general manager role of that business, and we completely restructured it and brought it down from 180 people to around 30 people in a very short space of time. And all of those, the majority of people that worked in that business didn't speak English. So I had, just this incredible experience, in a business that wasn't going well over there. I was under enormous pressure trying to save the business, and I learned a lot about myself and during that time.
Just go back to that leadership moment where you made that decision to change your course and go over there.
Yeah.
Andrew and I have talked about it a fair bit. Decision making's a really big part of leadership and business. Was there a moment where you just said, that's it, I have to do this, or was it a gradual instinctive kind of feeling that grew?
It did grow because I was – you know, I was visiting China regularly, probably 8 times a year. So I could see at the start of the year in January 2014, Mr. Song announced to all of his people in his annual company meeting that it was going to be a tough year. And I'd never heard Mr. Song mention that before. So I thought that's a bit of a warning sign. So then I saw things unfold over the next few months, and I realized, and so I started probing about what was going on in their business. I got more information, and I realised that they were in trouble, and so I started to think about how I could help them, and what impact that could have on our business in Australia. So I started having discussions with our family at the same time, And then we sort of came to the conclusion that, you know, I'd give it a go on behalf of the family, and we had my brother-in-law could back me up and run the business in Australia, and, you know, so we were able to do it. We're able to structure it that I could go and have a crack at it.
So it was a mission to save two businesses.
In a way, it was, yeah. Yep. So, yeah, and in the end, I ended up walking away from the business over there because I couldn't help him anymore. And the unfortunate outcome of it was that I'd worked so hard for 3 years or so, 3 or 4 years, to develop a relationship with our Chinese partner. And that was, everyone told me that the relationship you have with your partner is so important, and that's the foundation for your business. By the end of that process, that our relationship had broken down. And so I suppose I'd lost confidence or faith in him as an individual, the way he does his business, and he lost confidence in me. I wasn't able to achieve what he wanted me to achieve in his business in a very short space of time. So
how do you pick yourself up after that period? You might have self-doubt,
yeah,
or,
yep.
I mean, what sort of process did you go through? Yeah.
Yeah, I was in no man's land for a while, to be honest.
And what year was this, roughly?
That was late, so I was up there from sort of June, July 2014 to November, December. So it's about 4 or 5 months. So I was in no man's land. I actually, in a way, I felt like I had post-traumatic stress. I'd been through such a company that was in free fall, was effectively in administration, and I was fighting off, I was fighting fires every day. Like I felt like I was fighting for my life every day, or fighting for that business's life. So I took that on very personally. And so by the end of it, I was pretty cooked. And so I really needed to take stock. I ended up taking a little bit of long service leave and just had some time out. Went to KI and chilled out and
drank some gin.
Yeah, that's right, exactly. So I just had to regroup. And part of that regrouping process was working out whether we wanted to be partners with the Chinese, Mr. Song. And I think we came to a conclusion as a family at that point that we didn't want to be partners with him because he couldn't help us in the same way that he could.
And the hard part is coming to that realization actually means a shitload of work ahead of you to extricate yourself. It's not like we make a decision, we cut and run. It's like we make a decision, now the next thing begins.
Yep, that's right. So it was another, we then took the better part of 12 months to try and come up with a plan, come up with a team to help us try and exit him from the business.
And it must have felt like a trauma because, I mean, a little bit like the Crows in the grand final, in that at quarter time,
we're not ready to bring that up.
We're flying. Yet, right? You know, it's not that things were putting along and then it went down. It was like this, you're picturing a certain thing, and then I'm assuming about a year later, year and a half later, you're sitting there as a family trying to, how do we save this thing?
How do we save it?
I keep coming back. What were the personal mechanisms that you used to kind of get through this period, whether it was nutrition, whether it was running, whether it was, like you said, counsel.
Yep. My foundation's always been exercise and getting out and, you know, running or swimming or cycling, you know, just to have a release. And I made sure that I maintain
through it.
And the great thing about the thing that got me through China was a group of Aussies that I hooked up with that were footballers. And they formed a team called the Chengdu Ruse. And literally a couple of weeks after I was there, they were having a game against the Shanghai Scorpions. And so they were on the lookout for anyone who could kick a football. And so I joined those blokes and trained with them and drank with them and then played a game of Aussie rules at age, 49 or whatever, and had a blast. You know, it was fantastic. And the experiences like that, helped get me through. So apart from that, I also have been part of a group called YPO, which is, you know, Young Presidents Organisation. And, you know, we have a group called a forum within that, and there's 8 or 9 blokes, and, you know, we meet monthly, and, they have been incredible to me, you know, in terms of giving me counsel and support and guidance, you know, through that whole experience. I was having Skype conferences with these guys, you know, trying to workshop ways around some of the challenges that I was facing there. Certainly seeking counsel of people that you trust and you value, you know, their opinions is really important.
Because the perception from the outside is you guys are flying in the beginning, and like you said, you're the poster child of SA economy.
Yep.
And there would be a lag time between them people realising actually where you're at. And so you're probably having to have a lot of conversations saying it's not quite what you think it is. And that being vulnerable like that must be difficult.
Yeah, and look, face, what they call face in China, is really important. And in a way, we have our own face in Australia. So, Gemtree was a poster, a poster child, and you know, we were regarded as a success story. And then when things started to unravel, we were potentially losing face. And, I know a lot of people in McLaren Vale were really jealous of Gemtree and what we were achieving. And in the end, you know, they would have been seeing what was going on and, could have been making a few comments.
Tall poppies.
The tall poppy syndrome. You got to suck that up and just get on with life and treat it as a learning experience. And I'm a lot tougher and wiser as a consequence of that experience. And, you know, if you said, would you do it again? I probably would. I'd probably have a crack, you know, because I didn't see any other way forward.
Well, that was going to be my next question. On reflection, on balance, how do you look back at that story, that journey, and go, you know, we had some incredible highs, incredible lows. Would I do it again? And do I allow myself to look back and say, geez, I regret doing that. If only I'd done this, if only I'd done that.
Yep.
How do you reflect on that?
I do. Look, you can't, it's very hard not to have regrets and to go through that thought process. And I've done that a few times. But I keep going back to when it was happening. 9 out of 10 people said, you've got to have a crack at this. You know, how many times do you get an opportunity where someone is prepared to basically come into your business and help supercharge it and transform it? And,
the upside, you know, is so great.
There was so much potential upside no one was telling me, you're mad to do this. I mean, people were saying there are pitfalls in having a Chinese partner and, you know, so I definitely heard those messages. And, you know, if I'd done things differently, I would have structured our shareholder agreement differently. And, probably the way that we structured the way that he invested in our business. And I probably didn't, you know, negotiate as well as I could have, you know, at a couple of key moments, you know, through that process.
So you've got this incredible case study now of you in your own world. How does that inform and help you with organic and raw? And I'm assuming, you know, you mentioned Coke and partnerships and maintaining, you know, the true values of the business. How has that influenced your time so far, do you think?
Well, interestingly, organic and raw has been very conservative in the way that they've grown the business. So Gemtree grew its business using a Chinese partner, but also bank finance. So there was a fair bit of debt attached to Gemtree in its growth, whereas Organic and Raw has virtually no debt. So the shareholders have been very committed to reinvesting profits into the business and making sure that they don't spend beyond their means, so to speak. So that's been, for me, that's been a really refreshing experience. To come into a business that is in such a strong position financially moving forward. And but I'm, you know, what I'm saying shareholders is you need to invest. You still need to invest in marketing. to grow the brand, to, you know, we're moving into a whole different phase of the business now. So it is important, you know, to invest in some things that you haven't invested in the past.
Personally, are you re-energized for another real crack?
Absolutely, mate. Yeah, I definitely lost my mojo, and you know, people talk about what mojo is, but I definitely did lose my mojo, and I got it back probably around a month or two before I started working in this business. And you know, and I'm not going to lose it again. You know, it's a great journey. It's so exciting, and to be part of a business that you produce products that absolutely enhance people's health and well-being is a great thing. I can, you know, confidently go out there every day and sell our product and market our product and know that I'm helping people. In the wine business, I was doing that in a different way, and you know, wine, you can talk about wine, it has health properties and whatever, but you know, ultimately it's still alcohol. So you know, so I was making people's lives more enjoyable in the wine business, but in this business, you know, there's a real authenticity about being able to help people.
It's almost like Organic and Raw have found you. You know, it just came along at the right time. Yeah. It's the perfect antidote.
Yeah, the timing, you couldn't have picked it any better. So, and I have to wake up and remind myself or pinch myself that I'm working in a business like this. Because to me, it's the perfect fit for who I am. And so I don't, there's you know, I've had some discussions with other people about other business opportunities, but it's not the same alignment or fit with my values and who I am. And so, yeah, it's, you know, I couldn't have asked for better.
To perhaps dream a little bit, what are some of the ambitions or in a perfect world, where do you see this brand going?
We haven't gone offshore yet. So, and the reason for that is the market in Australia is still underdeveloped. So there's more, you know, there's more that needs to be done here, and it's easier for us to, we will get greater return for investing in the Australian market first before we go offshore. So, yeah, we want to take the brand to Asia. There's no doubt about that. And I suppose
that's... Are you ready to go through that process again?
Yeah. So, well, give me another year or two and I'll
You won't call Mr. Song. Yeah. You might speak to someone else.
Yeah. Yeah, so I mean, that's one of the reasons they brought me on is, you know, ultimately they thought that we would start exporting our product. But so part of it is, okay, we start as kombucha, then we introduced other health and wellbeing products. So we've got a new product called Mojo Tonic, which is a sparkling health tonic that's completely different on the palate. It's more soft drink like in its flavour profile, but it's got probiotics in it, so it's enhancing people's, you know, gut health. So that's, we've got a pipeline of product development going on in the business, and you know, even things like skincare is something that we're having a look at. So there's very different arms of the business that I think you'll see develop over the next 5 years, and you know, who knows what part of the business I'll be working on, but I imagine there'll be, you know, different opportunities presented, and I may, you know, may move in a slightly different direction within the business, which is an exciting thing for me.
You talk about it like it's yours, which I think is a great indicator of, I think, your alignment and your buy-in. I mean, are you an investor? Are you allowed? Is that?
I hope to be.
Yep.
Yeah. That's certainly the discussions I had with the shareholders when I started. So, I treat it as my own. And for me, after being involved in a family business and being invested in that family business, it was very important for me to be able to move, if I was going to move into another business, that I was invested in some way in the future and I could share in the success of that business.
A little bit of rapid fire?
Explain the context.
Oh, no, here we go.
And this, it's, we call it shit rapid fire because we deliver it so poorly. it allows us to just throw random punters questions at you in quick succession.
God.
Right. I've got and the other expectation is that there's no sitting on the fence. So you can't say I'm not sure or
you commit to an answer.
Yeah. Yep.
My first one, best thing about China.
Great answer.
I could I actually don't want to answer that. Gambay.
Okay. That's a place, I'm assuming.
No, Gambay is bottoms up.
Oh.
So it's a ritual where you
drink
up, and I had a lot of gambays with a lot of Chinese people, which is the Chinese toast.
Well, worst thing about China, is that also a gambay?
No.
Next morning.
Airports and going through airports I had enough of.
You keep referring to the family. The most annoying family member.
Oh, no. Probably my brother-in-law.
Outside of wine, your favourite drink? A very specific drink. Like, I'm talking specific? Brand. What is it?
Right now, Asahi beer.
Ah, very good.
Mm.
What do you miss most about the wine industry?
God, that's an interesting one. Look, to be honest, I'm not missing much about it.
Yeah,
so
cool. You were ready.
I was done. Yep. I was ready to go. Yep. So, look, I missed some of the people and the relationships, to be honest. I've formed some great friendships with people all over the world, and that's what I miss, the contact with those people.
So as a quick follow-up, one or two of the biggest characters in the wine world that you know?
Look, I mean, some of them aren't around. A guy called Wayne Thomas was a great character. He's was a larger-than-life personality. A guy called Greg Trott. From Wirra Wirra, very a visionary and someone who I admired and I wanted to, you know, sort of he gave me inspiration to, you know, try and make McLaren Vale a better place and market it better, you know, to punters around the world. So, I've met so many larger-than-life personalities in the wine business. It's not funny.
If you weren't in the world of beverages, what would you be doing?
What would I be doing? Probably property development. Yeah, so our family's involved, you know, in Rossdale Homes and, you know, my father's always been into doing some property development. So it's something that I'm interested in, but I don't have the same passion as what I'm doing now for it, but it's certainly something I'm interested in.
Favourite at the moment, favourite physical pursuit?
Running. So I run competitively. I run track running in a league called the South Australian Athletics League. So I'm in the pursuit of a number one position on the podium, and I haven't got there yet. So
what distance?
Anywhere from 100 metres up to 800 metres to 1,000.
What's your quickest time for 100?
Well, this is all over, it's handicapped. So we don't.
Like the stall gift.
Yep. Yep. So Bay Sheffield, those sorts of events. That's the league that I run in. So, I get a huge buzz out of it, but my body, as I get older, is finding it, harder to hold together. So, I reckon I've probably got another year or so only in that pursuit, and then I'll probably after that ride, you know, cycling and a bit of swimming.
When you're running, what's playing through your headphones?
I don't ever run with headphones.
Really?
Yeah. I've never found the need to. I just love running and getting the fresh air in and watching what's going on around you. So, yeah, doesn't music and running, it's never been something that I've associated with.
In your business journey, the most euphoric moment. So often I refer to the Jerry Maguire free-falling, you know, Tom Cruise just done the deal.
Yep.
Have you had a moment?
Yep. Euphoric moment was signing the in China, in Zigong, in Mr. Song's office, signing the heads of agreement with him after negotiating that heads of agreement for, several months. It was leading into it, and then over 3 days, three very intense days with his lawyers and me. It was me versus him, basically.
You and your lawyers?
No, I didn't have any lawyers with me. It was he had three lawyers and his team, and it was me. So it was a very intense period, but quite a euphoric thing at the end. And I handed him a Adelaide Crows jumper in commemoration of the event. And then beyond that euphoria, when I hopped on the plane, I actually had a moment of emotion where I actually started crying when I sat on the plane and I thought, fuck, I've changed my family's life's destiny, you know. And it was just one of those amazing moments that it just came over you, and I didn't see it coming.
So, look, last question. But then what do you think then of like a Port Adelaide who does a deal then with a Chinese? Do you think, oh, I wonder how complicated that's going to get?
Yep. It's not, it won't all be what it's cracked up to be. That's all I can say. You know, the partner that they've partnered with up there, you know, who knows how committed he is to that partnership. And, you know, so, yeah, it'll be more challenging than what they expect it to be.
Andrew, I've just had the best hour or so. I don't even know how long we've been going for. I feel like we could keep going, but you've got a beautiful, articulate, and you know, measured way of, I guess, giving us your story and what's ahead for Mojo and Organic Raw. And I've just loved, and I speak on behalf of Andrew, mate. Thanks for coming to our podcast, and I can't wait to get down to Wollonga and just sample straight from the vat.
No problem.
Do you do that? You'll like be wine? Welcome. Do you sort of
not
open
really.
The bat? Not really?
Not okay. really.
Well, yeah, we'll crack a bottle down there.
Do you have a cellar door?
No. I'd love to have a cellar door in the city here, you know.
Well, we'll introduce you to the Whistle and Flute guys, Josh Baker and the guys, and they might be able to put a little hole in the wall down in Pink Moon Deli. So, Andrew,
sounds great. Thanks guys.
Thanks for
really, along. Really appreciate it and really enjoyed it.
Thanks for listening to our interview with Andrew Buttery. For more information about Organic and Raw beverages, visit organicandraw.com.au. We have plenty of interesting interviews in the bank and many more to come. So subscribe to Rooster Radio, and if you like what we're doing, leave us a review in iTunes and connect with us at roosterradio.biz.